And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Very auspicious start to the program. We're speaking today with this hour. We go in-depth on national security and privacy issues with co-author of the book Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. He's journalist and author David Brown, who writes under the pseudonym D.B. Grady. He's a former U.S. Army paratrooper and Afghanistan war veteran. D.B. Grady, a.k.a. David Brown, joins us from public radio station WRFK in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Welcome to you, David.
Thank you for having me today.
Oh, good afternoon. Welcome to you. So, obviously, your book was published before the actions of Edward Snowden. I'd like to know what your views are on his disclosures and if it changes any of the ideas or content in your book.
One of the satisfying things since the Edward Snowden revelations is that it actually confirms a tremendous number of things that we actually reported or stories that we broke in the book. So that's a pretty exciting thing. With regard to Snowden himself, obviously, he committed a great many criminal violations, but I would defend him only by saying that he's essentially attacking a system that I would consider to be morally and intellectually bankrupt. So from that point of view, good for him, and it's better for the country that he did what he did.
Couldn't he have used a little smarter methods instead of these laptops going to Russia and this, that business?
Well, I would ask Bradley Manning that. Certainly, if Snowden had made the revelations that he made and made himself a target for the law enforcement, he would pretty much be under a prison right now. We would never see him again.
In light of the great pains you took to avoid harming the national security when you wrote the book, what are your feelings about his actions? You said some of them are criminal, but you say that it's a bankrupt system.
Right. Well, if we look going all the way back to the WikiLeaks revelations, we can say, what are the consequences to this? And the consequences have not been quite so terrible as we were led to believe, especially when they broke. We were led to believe that national security in the country would collapse, the terrorists would win, so to speak. And none of that's happened. The foreign policy of the United States continues unabated. As a matter of fact, since WikiLeaks, one thing that we've actually learned is that the United States actually does a pretty good job overseas. We do what we say we're going to do, and we do a fine job of it. So with regard to Snowden, we're going to see in the coming years certainly reform with regard to law enforcement. I would love to see a remake of the Church Commission, but that remains to be seen.
The book says that important secrets get out while unimportant ones don't. Could you expand on that?
Well, when we talk about necessary secrets, I guess what you're referring to versus frivolous secrets, There are certain secrets in the United States that you absolutely do need to keep, okay? The security of the President of the United States of America, that is always going to be paramount. That's a secret that can never leak for sake of the country. The nuclear launch codes, to use a dramatic example, that's a similar kind of leak that we do not want to get out there. But there are frivolous secrets out there. For example, what we see in a lot of instances are news clippings from, say, the New York Times. Well, that passes through a government official's desk. It ends up getting marked classified. Well, why do we have something that's on the front page of the New York Times legally classified or legally considered something that cannot leak out or it would harm the United States? That's insane.
Were you required to obtain security clearance to publish this book? And how forthcoming, as far as you know, were your sources?
I would say that our sources were extremely forthcoming obviously, no, we didn't have to submit the book to anybody for any sort of official stamp of approval. That said, we did speak with members of the intelligence community and run various revelations that we had by them, just to make sure that, you know, terrible things wouldn't happen.
Expand on the notion that secrecy is an industry and tell us about Operation Ragtime. And should security be outsourced?
Well, when we refer to the secrecy apparatus of the United States, or the government secrecy industry, I think is in the subtitle, we're talking, of course, about the intelligence community, but also the massive government contractor base that is built around it. One thing that we saw that was interesting, after the start of World War I, we saw that Germany and the Axis powers were building, had built a very effective war machine. They built a lot of tanks, they built a lot of planes, things like that. And the United States got into the war and said, yeah, we'll go ahead and do that too. And we did that. We built a massive military overnight. We had the planes, we had the boats, we had the weapons and the tools. After 9/11, a very similar thing happened. We were going up against an enemy this time that was able to effectively operate secretly, an enemy that was able to keep secrets, so to speak, and strike without warning. And we built the exact same system. It's very much along the lines of what we did after World War II. So this system's been built. The problem is we can't really unbuild it. Just like after World War II, we still have a standing military of, you know, mass millions of troops. We still have a sprawling military-industrial complex. And now what we're seeing is sort of an intelligence-industrial complex. And I don't foresee a time when it's going to go away.
I want to follow up on what Joe asked. Would you tell us about Ragtime? It's A, B, C, and especially P?
Right. Ragtime is part of the president's surveillance program, or the terrorist surveillance program. And these were the programs that were put into place after 9/11. With regard to National Security Agency domestic surveillance. The President's Surveillance Program, when we get down to, really when we get down to the brass tacks of the thing, the President's Surveillance Program gives the executive branch a tremendous amount of power to surveil members of American citizens or American or U.S. persons, as it's called at the NSA, without a tremendous amount of limitation. They go through the FISA court officially. After 9/11, obviously, FISA court was very much minimized, and that was the huge problem. That was the scandal that came along. But that's precisely the system that was put into place. What's interesting to look at is after the New York Times had the incredible revelations about warrantless wiretapping in the United States, government surveillance of U.S. citizens, everyone was outraged. And rather than stop what they were doing, the state said, well, we'll just make it legal. And so the same activities that were going on then are going on today, and the outrage has disappeared. So it's interesting with the Snowden revelations. Once again, these sorts of things are making it to the front pages of the press, and that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. A conversation is long overdue.
And Ragtime P, the P stands for Patriot? The Patriot
Right,
Act?
Right, that's part of the Patriot Act that authorized a lot of these, what you might say are onerous or certainly aggressive surveillance programs. Ragtime itself is a series of mechanisms and databases that allow the National Security Agency to kind of sort this information out. It's various. If you're talking about terrorism, it goes into one database. If you're talking about weapons proliferation, weapons of mass destruction, and so on, that's going into a database. And when you're talking about domestic surveillance, that's obviously another one right there.
How does the NSA determine whether talking about an American individual poses a potential threat? What do they use to determine that?
Generally speaking, and as it should be done, I mean, I've said some pretty harsh things about the NSA since the start of this conversation, but I do want to say that they're doing an important job, and the men and women who are actually analyzing this data, I mean, they're patriots, and they're trying to protect us, and that's a good thing. And these things get carried away over time, and there are certainly problems at the higher levels, the higher echelons, with regard to taking responsibility and doing the right thing. But these people are doing a great job in trying to protect us. Now, the National Security Agency itself, I'm sorry, perhaps you could clarify your question a little more with regard to...
Well, how, I mean, obviously, according to the Fourth Amendment, there needs to be probable cause to monitor an individual, right?
Right.
So what would they, what did, were you able to determine what they used to determine if an individual poses a potential threat?
What kind of flag?
Sure, sure. These types of investigations are generally conducted along with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. So the FBI is going to find information that suggests the Bob in Dayton, Ohio, has been in communication with a known al-Qaeda cell in Kyrgyzstan. They've got that bit of information. They need another, as the rules have been sort of applied since 9/11, they need another bit of corroborating information before they go in and start listening to what Bob has to say on the phone. Once they get that information, once that investigation is so compelling that it becomes a national security issue where we need to know what this guy is saying, then the FBI and the National Security Agency go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and they get approval from a FISA court judge that says, yes, go ahead and start listening in on this guy. Go ahead and wiretap him. And that's the way it's supposed to work. Now, what we've seen since 9/11, something on the order of 36,000 requests have been made to the FISA court, and something like 11 were rejected. Mm. So that's, I mean, if we're talking about the effectiveness of law enforcement, we're going to have to assume that either the FBI and the NSA are the most effective and flawless law enforcement agencies in the history of mankind, or maybe the FISA court is just a little too lenient in what they give permission with regard to domestic surveillance.
We're speaking with David Brown. Why do you have a pseudonym? Why do you write under the pseudonym D.B. Grady?
Well, my name's David Brown, so it's a pretty generic name.
Right.
There are about 4 billion of us.
Oh.
Right,
okay.
Right. No, I'm not on the run from the mafia or anything like that.
No, I didn't think so.
Because you're also a novelist.
That's correct.
Anyway, we are speaking with David Brown. He writes under the pseudonym D.B. Grady. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic and a national security columnist for The Week. And along with Mark, Ambinder, he's written Deep State Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and speak more and take some calls and emails. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and David Brown, also known as D.B. Grady. We're talking about the book Deep State Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. If you'd like to join in, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
And you can tweet us at Topical Currents. I listened to an interview with Mark. It's Ambinder, right?
Ambinder.
Ambinder. Oh, Ambinder. Okay, I guess they said it wrong. Anyway, he said this very prescient quote. He said, "One of the most frustrating things about writing a book on secrecy is how quickly the debate changes." And I thought, in light of the Snowden revelations, how has that changed the debate since you wrote the book?
It's really interesting. If we go back to the start of when the book was written, that was before Osama bin Laden had been killed. So we started over, and we were really excited, because so many government leaks occurred, and a lot of people were willing to talk in the intelligence community. So it was a great thing. And then we really had a lot of progress in the book done. And then the Bradley Manning WikiLeaks situation happened. So suddenly we're kind of having to start over again. It's a lot of great new material, but it's constantly starting over. You're constantly trying to keep up with the debate, as Mark said. So since Snowden came out, one of the things that we were very interested to see was one of the questions you had earlier. How forthcoming were the people we spoke with? I mean, were we being fed false information to perhaps dissuade the enemy or whatever? And as it turns out, most things that Snowden addressed that we also addressed were right on target. And in some cases, you know, 3 years ago, we didn't go into a lot of detail about certain revelations that Snowden had at the time. Now that they're out, obviously, that part we would have obviously added that to the book had we written it today. But overall, I would say that it was a tremendous experience. It's a tremendous. I don't want to say that it's invigorating or exciting, because it is kind of a scary thing when you talk about dealing with what is secret, what is not secret, what should be secret, who will be safe and who won't be safe. That's always an interesting kind of fuzzy line. But it was very, very gratifying to see so many of our disclosures and revelations be proven accurate.
Mm. You say in the book there are good leaks and there are bad leaks. What do you mean? What's a good leak?
A fine leak would be, for example, what a man named Thomas Drake did a few years ago. He was a high level official at the National Security Agency. This was at the start of the warrantless wiretapping program, whereby the National Security Agency was listening in on the conversations of American citizens without judicial approval. And there's one rule at the National Security Agency, or there was, and that rule was you don't listen to Americans. It's a pretty easy rule to follow. Just listen to people who aren't Americans and not on U.S. soil. And the National Security Agency was doing just the opposite. They were listening in on Americans. And Drake went to his supervisors and said, "Hey, guys, this is wrong. This is not what we do." And he was told, essentially, just stop asking so many questions, Tom. So finally, he had no recourse. He went as high as he could with the National Security Agency, and eventually he went to the press. And he said, "Look, I want to talk about this program." And so now we know now about the warrantless wiretapping program because of this, what I would consider to be a very courageous act by a member of the intelligence community. And what you have to understand, if you work for the intelligence community, if you do something like this and you're caught, you lose your security clearance, you lose your job, a burn notice is put on you, essentially. You're persona non grata for the remainder of forever.
Is that what happened to him? Community.
That is exactly what happened to him. So he went from being a high-level official at the National Security Agency to working at an Apple store. And that's a tremendous personal sacrifice that he made, but he made it for the betterment of America. And it's indisputable that America is a better place today because of what he did. And so whistleblowers like Thomas Drake do remarkable work. They do things that I don't know that personally I could do. I don't know that I could sacrifice the livelihood of my family for sake of some intangible freedom or democracy or however I might understand it. I don't know that I have the moral courage to do that, but he did. So that's a good leak. Similar revelations like the salt pit prison facility in Afghanistan, where aggressive enhanced interrogation techniques took place, and in some cases deaths of people we were torturing. Those kinds of things need to come to light. If we follow the letter of the law, if the men and women engaged in these activities follow the letter of the law, those revelations will never come forward, ever. They will never come to light. So when they do these sorts of things, that's a good leak. They're making a personal sacrifice, and they are bettering America. Now, a bad leak, a fine example of a bad leak, or many bad leaks, came after the death of bin Laden. After that raid, suddenly we started knowing everything about the way the Joint Special Operations Command operates. We started learning everything about the really granular level stuff about how SEAL Team 6 operates. One thing leaked were passenger manifests of helicopters involved with the raid. Now, there's no benefit to America, to society, to democracy, to freedom that could possibly be gained from leaking the names of operators who are involved in these types of high-risk missions. But they leak all the same. That's a bad leak. That's a leak because somebody wanted to impress a reporter somewhere at a bar.
You've been talking about wiretapping surveillance of U.S. citizens. How about email? And what's the how is that accomplished? If I write David Brown an email and copy Bonnie Berman in Miami Beach, do people monitor that? Or are there certain flags that say we need to look at this email?
You know, that is a really interesting question. And only a few months ago, before the Snowden revelations came forward, General Keith Alexander, who's the head of the National Security Agency, was brought before Congress to do his regular testifying on whatever programs were going on, just to give the Intelligence Committee what they need to know to move forward and make good laws. And he was asked exactly that. He said, look, let's say tomorrow the Vice President of the United States decides anytime somebody writes something bad in an email about me, I want to know and I want to be able to go after and arrest this guy. And that's a legitimate question. And General Alexander said, we do not have the technical capabilities to do that. It would require massive amounts of computing resources in order to be able to do that sort of thing, and we just don't have it. So to answer your question, at the time that General Alexander gave that answer, the answer was no, they won't know. I mean, essentially they won't know unless they had some reason to believe that you and I were conspiring in some sort of illegal national security threat.
And what about now, Internet? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, what's very interesting now, what we're seeing is deep in the Utah desert, there is a massive data center that the National Security Agency has constructed. It uses this one data center, which its whole job is to collect information. It uses roughly the same amount of electricity as the entirety of the Walt Disney World Resort. Okay, so massive amounts of power, massive amounts of computing resources. What General Alexander was talking about, he didn't say, no, it's impossible. He said it's impossible right now. Well, guess what? Now we suddenly have the technological capabilities to do exactly what you just posed, the question you just posed, which, can they do it? Well, they have the computing resources to do it now. Are they doing it? That's a great question going forward. They certainly have the resources to do it.
I suppose that would also include Internet searches.
Certainly. And Internet searches are a big part of PRISM, which is one of the programs leaked by Snowden. We've known for a long time, and we wrote about that. I think Julian Assange was talking about this in 2010, where major Internet communications companies essentially have interfaces built into their system for the intelligence community to, I don't want to say plug into and get what information they need, but certainly, if not at a technical level, at a human level, say, hey, Bob, let's go ahead and initiate the PRISM protocol, or however they might say it, and let's go ahead and start monitoring all the Internet searches from Bill and Orlando, Florida. So, yes, they can do it. I mean, it is a technical... It's technically feasible, and we know now that the interface through which they do it is called PRISM. Are they doing it on a massive scale in real time? The answer is probably not, just because of the number. I mean, 400 million searches a day are conducted on Google, so that would be a massive amount of data. Can that be handled at the Utah data center or at the various other data centers run by the National Security Agency? Well, it's a possibility, and one thing that we're seeing, one defense that certainly the FBI has made with regard to their massive retention of data records has been, well, the Constitution is too slow. We need to be able to store this massive amount of data in order to sift through it and then pull the data we need, and then we'll release the data. Well, that's not really how the Constitution works, but they're basically saying, yeah, we're able to store a massive amount of data and then dig through it and then find what we need, or data mining, as they might call it. So, to answer your question, probably and maybe.
I suppose there'd be flags, such as if I'm looking for bomb-making instructions or
well, yeah. I mean, certainly if they're just going to do passive surveillance and just monitor anyone who might mention any type of terrorist activity, then, yeah, there would be certain flags like that. And I know there has been leaked a list of things that the NSA looks for whenever they're monitoring certain communications, and such things as bomb making, or even the mention of, say, the National Security Agency. That those are flags that trigger. But that also assumes passive surveillance, and it would be a tremendously inaccurate way of doing things, if only because, like you mentioned earlier, I'm a novelist and I'm writing a novel about a spy right now. So if I want to know how to make a bomb, does that make me a terrorist? Does that put me in a database that says this guy might be a terrorist?
Does it?
Well, the answer is, maybe I am.
Mm. We're speaking but, with... I'm sorry, go on.
No. I'll just add one more thing to that. One thing that we have seen since the stories have broken on what the National Security Agency is doing, once you get into these databases, certainly with the FBI databases, you don't get out. There's no purging of the database. Once you're in there for suspicious activity, you're going to be in there until you're dead.
Sort of like the airlines.
Exactly.
We're speaking with D.B. Grady, or David Brown, and he is a correspondent for The Atlantic and national security columnist for The Week. And we're talking about his latest book, Deep State Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. Another break, and we'll be right back.
And 35 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with D.B. Grady about the book that he co-wrote. The book is Deep State Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. If you'd like to join in the conversation with a comment or a question, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, radio at WLRN.org, and Twitter, that's at Topical Currents. Tell me, David, many Americans, I think, just take the idea that I have nothing to hide, so why should we be concerned about surveillance?
Well, that's a pretty short-sighted view. Everybody has something to hide.
I won't tell you mine.
Exactly. You won't tell me mine. But if I run a massive government surveillance program, I can just find out. The truth is, it would be like adding GPSs to everyone's cars and having a database that tracks every time you speed, you get a speeding ticket. How many of us speed going down the road a day? Everybody does. That's breaking the law. Very similarly, when we talk about various conversations, various things like that. Let me give an example of the kinds of things that we don't necessarily think about when we say, well, I have nothing to hide. Because I'm going to assume that no one in the audience is a bad person. We're all great people, and we all contribute to National Public Radio during the fundraising drives.
Well, they
of
better.
Course.
Of course. A couple of weeks ago, Facebook had a data breach. They accidentally leaked what they referred to as shadow profiles to just regular members of Facebook who had downloaded their data. Now, what is a shadow profile? And this is all going to come around back to what the NSA can conceivably do, and almost certainly does do. When I join Facebook, I make it a point not to put my phone number in there. There's no reason for anyone to have my phone number. You guys can call me, but nobody else. And so that's my little stake in the ground that says I will not cross this line. I don't want them to have my phone number. Whenever people install Facebook on their iPhones and on their Android devices, though, the first thing that it does is says, hey, do you want to upload your address book so that we can find all your other friends on Facebook and you can be friends with them? I mean, that's kind of a cool, easy-to-use feature that we all want. We all want to be able to connect with our friends. So those phone numbers are uploaded. Facebook does just what it says. It connects all the different people, and then it moves on, and we don't think any more about it. Well, what ended up happening is people were uploading their address books, and Facebook was keeping them. And wouldn't you know it, it found, hey, there's David Brown in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who's connected to Bob Smith in Dayton, Ohio. Bob Smith's address book had David's phone number, so I'm going to go ahead and, in a shadow profile, a secret profile of David Brown, I'm going to go ahead and connect the phone number with the name. And that's just a small example. This is being conducted on a – and I don't want to sound – this should not sound alarmist, and I don't mean it to be. It's just fact. This is being conducted on a massive level. So suddenly these incredible profiles are being built with data that we have not provided, but with data that other people have provided. So you can imagine the types of detailed databases that are now being constructed about you and I. I mean, already, just the things that we give Facebook, we let them know the names of all of our friends, the names of all of our family. We even tag, this is mom and this is dad. They know where we live. They know, in fact, with photographs, they know our GPS coordinates, where we are at any given time. They know our religion. They know our political affiliations. These are the things that we give them. That's not even the things that they're just figuring out. And these are sophisticated algorithms that can easily put two and two together to figure out, well, he's friends with Bob. They're both politically whatever. And people who are involved with these, who are in the same circle of friends, are also involved in whatever political extremist group. Well, suddenly now we know these guys are probably part of an extremist group, and we can associate the two. And that's just benign Facebook data. Now, imagine on a massive scale the National Security Agency being able to do that exact same thing. The question you might, or the rejoinder you might say, is, well, there's no evidence that the National Security Agency is doing that. To which I would say, look at the job advertisements for what the NSA is hiring for today. If you read the Association for Computing Machinery magazine, which is a hardcore computer science college magazine, what we're seeing now, the National Security Agency is advertising in this magazine, which is hilarious in a way because computer science is such a counterculture industry. What these guys want are people able to do what's called data mining. They want to be able to drill down into data and extract massive amounts of data. Because look, if the NSA has everything about everyone all the time, that data is meaningless. You have to be able to find meaning in those connections. And that's what data miners do. That's what they want computer scientists today for. That's why they are so eagerly hiring as many as they can right out of college and giving them very big salaries. They need to be able to do that. And so that's the sort of thing that they're going to use. They're going to use that kind of information to construct these types of profiles.
You wrote in your introduction that we can judge the quality of a democracy by the kinds of secrets it keeps. So what are your conclusions about the state or the quality of our democracy?
Well, one conclusion that can be drawn from the types of secrets the government keeps certainly is that things have sort of gone off the rails a bit. When all of these things happen, look, in the days after 9/11, if you had told me, David, we want to be able to passively surveil certain neighborhoods with known terrorist extremists, we want to be able to know what's going on here. When the World Trade Center is still smoking, when it's smoldering ash and cell phones are still ringing under that rubble, of course I would have said, absolutely, go for it. I mean, do that. Protect me, right? That's what we all want. We all want to feel safe. Some 11, 12 years later, now that we have the clarity of mind and the ability to look back and say, there were some missteps taken, there were some overreach, there were some things that were done that were not necessarily for the best of America, that didn't benefit the anti-terrorist or the counter-terrorist regime that was put into place. At this point, American citizens can say, look, this is a bad thing. And if we look at a great many of the Snowden revelations, when we see that the NSA needs hundreds of millions of Verizon phone records to find terrorists, well, gosh, that seems like a bit excessive to assume that there are, or to guess that there are, hundreds of millions of possible terrorists, because that's how they can acquire that data, by making that sort of argument. Clearly, that's not in the best. It does not benefit democracy to do that sort of thing. So there has been an erosion in I would say, if not the effectiveness of the state, certainly in the moral clarity that we once had. So yes, there's been an erosion. Can it be corrected? Well, we're going to find out in the coming years. I know there's a vote tomorrow on certain provisions of the Patriot Act, or certainly on funding for the National Security Agency to engage in these types of activities. We're going to find out right then, 24 hours from now, has there been an erosion of democracy? If the powers of the NSA are curbed, then that's going to be a good thing. That's going to show that the government does respond to the people, or even if not responding to the people, does respond to the right thing. Because ultimately, that's what we want. We want a government that does the right thing, even when no one's looking.
We have a Giancarlo sent a tweet. What of the unprevented horrors, the Boston bombing and the school shootings? Where was the NSA then?
Precisely. I mean, I can't add anything to that. Now, look, even if we install a perfect system, even if on the worst case scenario, we install George Orwell-like telescreens in everyone's house that is watching and listening all the time, and we know everything going on at all times, there's always going to be lone wolves or crazy people who are going to one day pull a gun and kill somebody. That's always going to happen from now until the end of time. We will never be able to prevent that. Raymond Chandler once had a famous quote where he said, the easiest detective novels to solve are the ones where the authors try to get crafty and tricky. The ones that are most challenging to solve are the ones where at the last minute a guy pulls a gun and kills a guy. So that's always going to happen. There's always going to be a school shooting like that. And that's horrible to say. I have young children and the idea of it keeps me up at night. But it's going to happen. We're not going to be able to prevent that. But certain things, there's an awful lot that we don't know about the Boston Marathon bombings. Was that preventable? It may take a leak of government information to find out. One day we're going to know.
We're speaking with David Brown, writes under the name D.B. Grady, correspondent for The Atlantic, national security columnist for The Week, and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan and U.S. Army paratrooper, former U.S. Army paratrooper. The name of his book, Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. Another short break, and we'll be right back.
And it is Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, also D.B. Grady. We're talking about the book Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. It's co-written by Mark Amador. Tell me, David, is there a website associated with the book or yours that we can learn more about you and the book?
Well, I would encourage listeners to go to deepstate.org, which kind of takes you to just the all right, it takes you straight to the Amazon page to buy the book. but both Mark and I do a tremendous amount of writing for both The Week, for The Atlantic, even for some of the more out there sites like
Mental Floss. Yeah, what is Mental Floss?
Mental Floss is one of the most wonderful sites and magazines operating today. Some of my favorite people in the world put out some of my favorite articles, and it's generally trivia. It's kind of a trivia site, okay? If you like Jeopardy, you're going to love Mental Floss. And so one of our jobs is to kind of dig down and find really interesting things and write about them. So the cool thing about, you know, writing about spies and writing about this intelligence stuff, it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, this has been a pretty downer conversation. I don't think anybody feels like they've just been to Disney World after this phone call or after this conversation. But there are a lot of cool things going on in spies. There's a reason why we all want to be James Bond. So you're able to, I'm able to mine a lot of cool data from things that I've read over the years and put out some information that people might not know. And it's very satisfying. So that's what Mental Floss is.
Give us a thumbnail about your tour in Afghanistan, if you would.
Oh, it I wouldn't put it on par with any of these hardcore infantrymen who are really out there doing just, what I'm going to say, what they do is unimaginable for someone who hasn't done it. I have no idea what these guys do. I only know them in passing. I was a rotary wing non-commissioned officer, so my job was to coordinate between either the 101st Airborne or 82nd Airborne or 10th Mountain Division, their aerial assets. And then I was with the Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force, so I was able to make sure that all of our guys, if they needed to do an air assault operation, for example, my job was to make sure that that was going to go through and get on the helicopters, make sure the ring routes were going properly. So it was by far a safe place to be, and it was a very rewarding experience. That said, one tour in Afghanistan and I was done. I mean, war is not fun, and it's a very emotionally and physically exhausting place. but the men and women out there doing these just incredible things outside the wire, we can't thank them enough as Americans.
David, did you say it was deepstate.org or deepstate.com?
Deepstate.org.
.org.
We'll have that link on the Topical Currents Facebook page as well as the WLRN.org website.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. You said that tight security is one reason 9/11 occurred in the first place. Will you explain that?
Tight security is why 9/11 occurred. Oh,
one
right.
reason that 9/11 occurred.
Well, right. That's not with regard to things like airport security. That's with regard to within the intelligence community, a tremendous number of walls were built up over the years. One thing that we see with the intelligence community or with any organization that has to operate in the black, and these guys, they can't operate in the white. They can't operate in sunshine as a general rule, if only because if the CIA had a website that says, today we're investigating Bill Smith in Pakistan. I don't know if there are a lot of Bill Smiths in Pakistan. I don't want to slander anybody. But if they had to operate like that, obviously they couldn't do their job effectively. But we had an overreaction after the church hearings and after the 70s and after the 80s. A lot of very necessary, important, and great reforms were put into place. But we took them one step too far. And so what we ended up seeing happening, walls were built up between the various agencies. So when we talk about the National Security Agency versus the CIA had a very interesting name that I cannot repeat on the radio for people who worked for the NSA. Now we're seeing greater cooperation. So if the FBI has an idea that we think this guy might be a terrorist based on a long-term investigation, we need to know who this guy's talking to and what they're talking about. They have a cordial relationship where they can go to the NSA and say, hey guys, let's get on this. And that works very effectively. Similarly, in the field, in various combat zones, the Joint Special Operations Command, which we're talking about Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 and the mission support activity organizations like that. For a long time, there was a very, very strained and very antagonistic relationship between them and the Central Intelligence Agency because the CIA wants in on JSOC turf and JSOC wants in on CIA turf. So these guys are not going to work very well together. Well, after 9/11, again, we had a real national sense of purpose, and these guys were able to kind of break through these horrible bureaucratic barriers that basically crippled intelligence collection and military operations. They were able to work through those things in a lot of cases by way of regulation, but in a lot of cases by way of guys, men and women, picking up the phone, talking to each other and saying, hey, how can we work together to make this happen? And so when there were, with regard to too much secrecy prior to 9/11, I would say that's secrecy between agencies. We don't want to tell X agency what Y agency knows because suddenly Y agency will get less funding and X agency will get more. So things like that.
Okay, I understand. So tell us about this near shooting of Iranian President Ahmadinejad and why no one ever heard about it.
That was, when we first found out about that, we were astonished. What ended up happening in law enforcement, in the military, in any industry where you have to carry a gun for a living, an accidental discharge, as it's called, a bullet accidentally going off, that's a huge deal. Like that is something that an investigation will be launched, possible criminal charges will be filed against the agent or the officer or the spy or whatever who accidentally shot their gun, because there's nothing more dangerous than a bullet just whizzing by and possibly harming someone. Well, the Secret Service was providing one thing that a lot of people don't know. Whenever foreign dignitaries come to the United States, the Secret Service also protects them. And the Secret Service gives the same protection to foreign visitors that are foreign officials that they give to the President of the United States. It's hard to imagine, but a Secret Service agent would take a bullet for the President of Iran. What ended up happening, the motorcade had stopped carrying the President Ahmadinejad, and a Secret Service agent's vehicle mounted, I think it was an MP4, I'm not exactly sure of the weapon offhand, it accidentally fired a round. Ahmadinejad heard it, he turned, he looked, he shrugged, and he climbed back in his car like, what's going on, guy? Why are you doing this? And that was kind of the end of it. Everyone expected, after it happened, it went right to the White House, and everyone expected the worst, because look, this was at a low point between Iranian and American relations, and everyone expected Ahmadinejad to go to the floor of the United Nations and say just what you might think they would say: the Americans just tried to shoot me, the mm-hmm. Secret Service just tried to kill me. That didn't happen. In fact, it never leaked. The Secret Service certainly wasn't going to go out of their way to say, yeah, we accidentally fired a round next to the president of Iran, no big deal. They weren't going to do that. But Iran had no reason to keep it secret, except if we look at what was going on at the time, like I mentioned, relations were very rocky. Things were very bad at the time. And there was a lot of talk that we might go to war with them. Here Iran had a wonderful opportunity to really push things forward, to really, if they wanted a war, they could have had a nice reason to really get, you know, move forward on that. Mm-hmm. And they didn't. And what that tells us, and certainly what, you know, Mark and I, we spent a lot of time looking over it and talking to people, what it certainly suggested was maybe we're dealing with a more rational actor than they're given credit for. Maybe this kind of caricature of Iran that we have that says these guys are all evil and crazy and they're ready to blow themselves up and launch nuclear weapons against the United States, maybe that's a bit of hyperbole. Maybe at the end of the day, these guys want the same thing that we want. They want to live in some measure of peace and prosperity. They want the same thing for their people that we want for ours. So it tells us a lot about the strategic holding of secrets, that says we're not going to reveal this terrible thing that happened as a way of fostering civility in government or between governments.
Right. Well, we've been speaking with D.B. Grady, or David Brown, correspondent for The Atlantic, and with Mark Ambender. He wrote the book, Deep State: Inside the Government Security Industry. And thanks so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for listening. Our producer was Richard Ives. Technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, wlrn.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program looks at the psychological aspects of rebounding after a long-term spouse's death. Can octogenarians go full circle, even find a new love life? You may be surprised. And the calendar: on this day in 1846, 167 years ago, Henry David Thoreau protests slavery and the Mexican-American War by refusing to pay a $1 poll tax. He was jailed. Thoreau wore a neckbeard for many years. And on this day in 1888, 125 years ago, the birth of detective writer Raymond Chandler in Chicago. He created Private Eye Philip Marlowe and, of course, wrote The Big Sleep. William Faulkner wrote the screenplay. Bogart and Bacall starred. Howard Hawks directed. One more before we ease into the sheltered life. On this day 12 years ago, the death of author and photographer Eudora Welty in Jackson, Mississippi. Her house there is a national landmark. She won the 1973 Pulitzer Prize for the novel The Optimist's Daughter. We leave with a thought from Raymond Chandler, an American who fought in the Canadian military in World War II. Quote, "Ability is what you're capable of doing. Motivation determines what you do. Attitude determines how well you do it." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.